Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network for Tuesday, the 15th of July. Yesterday, President Bush announced lifting the executive ban on offshore oil drilling. Congress would have to lift its legislative ban before drilling could happen. The president said, "For years, my administration has been calling on Congress to expand domestic oil production. Unfortunately, Democrats on Capitol Hill have rejected virtually every proposal, and now Americans are paying at the pump." Democrats, this announcement from Representative Emanuel, Democrat of Illinois, said that the president's decision was a political stunt. We're going to be talking about offshore drilling this first hour of today's program, and we'll have very different viewpoints on the issue and welcome your phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee today, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Our guests are Sarah Banaszak. She is a senior economist at the American Petroleum Institute, and she draws on her oil and natural gas policy expertise as a spokesperson and policy analyst. She is focused on natural gas issues, including the need for additional terminals to facilitate natural gas imports. She has worked on access to domestic oil and natural gas resources and how the U.S. compares with other countries in its management and development of oil and gas resources. She has worked at the U.S. Department of Energy as a manager responsible for international oil and gas programs and domestic gas issues in the international context, including natural gas-related analysis and policymaking activities. Sarah, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
Also joining us is Holly Binns, and Holly works with Environment Florida, where she is field director. She directs the statewide energy and air quality campaigns, including Environment Florida's effort to reduce smog, soot, mercury, and carbon dioxide pollution from what is called the oldest and dirtiest power plants, and to stop rollback of critical clean air standards. She advocates in the state legislature and to other decision makers at the state level on Environment Florida's broader environmental agenda. She is not in favor of this lifting of the ban, and we welcome you very much, Holly, to the program. Hello.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Well, let's start with you and Sarah, and tell me why you think that this was a good decision by the president. Why does this moratorium need to be lifted?
Because it sends us towards a balanced future for our energy. And here's what I mean. In the future, we're going to need a lot more efficiency in this country. We're also going to need a lot more alternatives and renewable energy in this country. But no matter what you do, over the next 30 years, we continue to consume a lot of oil and gas. And we have to add supply to this system if we're going to keep consuming. So we're not going to be replacing our energy infrastructure overnight. So any forecast produced by the Department of Energy, doesn't matter which scenario, scenarios that include a lot more renewables, still have this oil and gas in the system. So we need to add these supplies. And what we've been doing in this country so far is adding these supplies with imports. So we're sending our dollars overseas. We're putting downward pressure on the value of our dollar. And we're foregoing the opportunity to have economic activity right here at home with the resources that we have. So, I mean, I think we could do this environmentally responsibly. We've demonstrated that in the Gulf of Mexico already. And there's a lot of resource that we could take advantage of.
And your opposition is based on what, Holly?
Well, there's, you know, I think a couple of reasons that we think that this is not the right policy. First of all, it's a huge missed opportunity to invest in the clean energy economy that creates high-wage jobs and puts us on the path to a smarter and cleaner energy future, one that helps us to start reducing global warming pollution. And then I think one of the other pieces of the puzzle is that, you know, we are talking about an industry that, you know, has a track record of, you know, certainly being cleaner now than they were 30 years ago, but still routine spills and releases, you know, small spills and releases are fairly common, as documented by the Minerals Management Service, the agency that oversees the industry. And, you know, we're talking about putting some of our you know, world-class beaches, some of the best beaches in the world, at risk for what is ultimately a small, you know, supply of oil that isn't going to reduce gas prices tomorrow, next week, next month, next year, or really in 10 years, to any significant degree, and that's according to the Bush administration's Energy Information Administration.
Do you agree with that, Sarah, that it's not going to reduce the price of oil fairly soon, if ever?
No, I don't. Well, I don't agree with a 10-year horizon. I mean, if we had put 10 years ago these resources under exploration and production, then we'd have these supplies right now today. So they can have an impact on the market. You know, it's going to depend on what resources. For instance, Florida, to get clean air and have clean energy, has turned to natural gas. But they built a pipeline to import the natural gas from other states that are producing offshore natural gas. Meanwhile, they have natural gas identified right, you know, more than 25 miles off the coast, where you're not going to see anything from the beaches. People are very happy going to the beaches in Texas and Alabama. And, you know, there's natural gas sitting right there that could be feeding Florida's own natural gas power plants, clean burning power plants, but their resources are currently off limits. So the time that it's going to take for these resources to get to market is going to depend on which resources. In fact, right now we don't even know a lot about some of these offshore areas that are under moratorium, because we only have data from maybe 1980s that even gives us insight to what kinds of resources are there. So that's one of the very first things we call for, is let's at least just do an assessment and understand what resources we have in our waters. You know, for instance, this area in Florida where the natural gas is already identified, even had wells drilled and then capped when things went under moratoria, could be in production far, far sooner than 10 years.
What about an assessment of what's there, Holly?
You know, the Department of Energy released a study recently that found that even if we opened up the Pacific, Atlantic, and Eastern Gulf regions, it wouldn't have a significant impact on domestic crude oil or natural gas production or on prices before 2030. That's a pretty long time from now. And it also found that, you know, the impact on average wellhead prices would be, quote, insignificant. So this idea that drilling off the coast of Florida or the rest of the continental United States is going to have any sort of near-term or long-term impact on gas prices, you know, it's just really a fantasy, and it's not my analysis that says that. That's the Bush administration's analysis that's telling us that. You know, the way that we're going to, you know, diversify our energy mix and that we should be thinking about moving forward is to put American technological know-how to work to jumpstart the clean energy economy. We have the capability and, you know, have already operating utility-scale solar thermal power plants. We have the ability to harness methane from landfills, which also helps to reduce global warming pollution. There are, you know, the Midwest of America is known as the Saudi Arabia of wind. There are significant clean energy resources, and to think that we're going to drill our way out of this problem is just a myth. We have about 3% of the world's oil supply. We consume just under 25% of the world's oil consumption. So, you know, it's a pretty simple math equation. We're never going to be able to drill our way to energy independence. And the idea that this is going to be some kind of bridge that's going to help in the short term is simply not true.
What about a congressional moratorium that we've had, Sarah, since 1982? Do you see any will on the part of the members of Congress to change their attitude?
I don't know about members of Congress. I don't talk to them on a regular basis, but I do know there have been a lot of public opinion polls that show that Americans overall are beginning to shift in their view about accessing the resources we have here at home. So I was informed of some poll results by Zogby when I was talking to somebody from Zogby. It's now the majority of Americans supporting access of these resources. I think there are some other polls as well.
But you would have to get congressional approval for this, am I right?
Absolutely. I mean, I would, like I said, I don't know. I mean, I guess anecdotally, I can read it in the newspaper that there's suggestion that some of the lawmakers who have previously opposed using our own resources as opposed to imports are now starting to turn on that. But I certainly am not polling Congress people, and I don't know, you know, where votes are yet.
Mm-hmm. Including the governor of Florida, who's changed his position on this, right, Holly?
Yeah, that's true. Charlie Crist campaigned on a pledge to protect Florida's coast from offshore drilling. It's been a position he's held for, you know, several decades that he's been involved in public office. And just a few weeks ago, he, in the wake of an announcement by Senator John McCain that he supported, that Senator McCain was calling for a lifting of the moratorium, Governor Crist made a stunning announcement, really, that he would consider drilling off of Florida's coast as well.
Mm-hmm. You have done work. Tell me more about this, Sarah, the work that you've done in terms of how U.S. compares with other countries in its management and development of oil and gas resources.
Well, I think in its approach to infrastructure overall, Americans can be quite different than other parts of the world. But in particular, I mean, you can look to other developed advanced economies that are also have strong environmental records, like Norway, which has promoted its offshore oil and gas industry, operating in an Arctic environment with great success and huge economic benefit to the country. And you also see this in the United Kingdom, in England, in the North Seas, a very active oil and gas industry that's benefiting the country there. So there are other countries, that we look to as sort of, relatively comparable in their views towards the environment and their level of economic advancement and their approach to energy policy, the kinds of things that they want in the future in terms of renewables and alternatives, but also acknowledging that one needs to add supply to the market while we make those, develop industries for wind and solar. Those kinds of industries are mostly for electric power. So the transportation industry is going to take probably even longer as we execute a transition to other kinds of fuels.
Let's talk just a little bit about that transition before we go to phone calls. We've been talking about this issue in America for years and years and years. Why are we so slow to develop alternatives, to develop renewables? What's the slowdown here?
Well, I think one of the reasons that it takes a little bit longer is just economics. I'm not sure that it really takes longer, but it gets absorbed in a very large economy. So I don't know. I mean, maybe Holly knows in terms of how many, wind-fired generation we have here versus other countries, but certainly we're the world's largest market for both transportation fuels and electricity. And so, transforming the infrastructure does take time. One of the reasons in the transportation industry oil has been so successful is that it's actually a very in engineering terms and energy terms, it's been a very successful way to sort of transport BTUs around. Our economy is also quite different from maybe, say, Europe in the size of the country. So the transportation that is used by Americans and, people choosing, having the ability to choose where to live and to, to travel with freedom to different places, across a vast country. So that's also, the size of this country and the size of the economy and the market are some things that differentiate us from other developed economies, plus a growing population.
Holly?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons that we have not seen a bigger growth in renewable energy as part of our energy mix and public transportation as a real viable option for, the majority of folks in the U.S. I think one piece of the puzzle is that, really the oil industry is the 800-pound gorilla, inside the Beltway. They are one of the most potent lobbying forces on Capitol Hill and, have done a pretty good job of protecting their own interest over the years, whereas the renewable energy industry has, far less of a capacity and an ability to be, in the mix on Capitol Hill, lobbying successfully for policies that help promote renewable energy development and the same sort of, kind of economic boost that has, for a long time helped more traditional energy sources. But then, some of the other pieces of the puzzle are particularly on transportation. Public transportation to work really well requires pretty significant population density, and the pattern of development in a lot of places in the U.S. is that we have fairly spread out suburbs, fairly spread out, downtowns, and so there's just not enough population density to make, mass transit a viable option the way it is in many parts of Europe, which are developed in a way that's much more compact. So there's going to have to be a multi-pronged approach to, addressing this problem. It's both switching from, primarily, gas-powered vehicles for for the transportation section to, flex fuel, alternative fuel, hybrid, electric, plug-in electric, vehicles. So that's part of the puzzle. And then we're also going to have to look at the way that we develop our cities and our counties so that we're looking at taking advantage of opportunities to, have more dense population centers so that we can more successfully utilize public transportation options.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests, and we'll take them in a moment. We're talking about the announcement made by President Bush yesterday that he's lifting an executive order banning offshore oil drilling and hopes to increase pressure on Congress to end this prohibition that was imposed in the year 1981. We're speaking with Sarah Banaszak, who is senior economist with the American Petroleum Institute, and Holly Binns, who's field director for Environment Florida. Our phone number, our lines are pretty busy, but keep on trying. The number is 800-486-8655, or in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, the author of What Your Stuff Says About You. The book is Snoop. Let's go to phone calls now for our guests. We start with Arlene from New Berlin. Hi, Arlene.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Oh, just fine. Listen, this is a very interesting topic and one close to my heart. What gets me so upset is that all these people want to drill here, there, and everywhere and do not know exactly how much oil we have to last us how long. I would hate to see something happened to some of these pristine areas that happened when the Exxon Valdez made a mess up in Alaska or wherever that is. You know, it's aggravating. People don't even have a right to say, no, we don't want them drilled there.
You want to take that one, Sarah?
Well, I do in the sense that I think there's a lot of the environmental record of the oil and gas industry that has changed over the last 20 years that people aren't quite aware of. And I think my industry has done a poor job of communicating what's going on. But, you know, this is not a static technology and a static process. This industry is driven by standards associations that constantly review to improve safety features and driven to use technologies to do things better and better. So, in 2005, we had these two huge hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico, Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita. They were both Force 5 hurricanes. They swept through the Gulf of Mexico. There were 3,000 oil and gas platforms. Three-quarters of all the platforms that are in the Gulf of Mexico were directly in the path of these Force 5 hurricane winds and waves. And there was no single major oil spill as a result of this. We've learned how to use subsea cutoff valves and sensors. We use seafloor operations increasingly instead of platforms. All sorts of technologies are being deployed. And so, in fact, when the National Academies of Sciences did a study a few years ago in the early 2000s about the source of the oil in the North American oceans, most of it comes from natural seeps. It doesn't come from the exploration and production industry. Some of it does come, it's like 0.001 from the oil and gas production industry. So there's far more oil in the oceans in our waters from natural seeps than from any operations of producing oil and gas.
Thanks for the call, Arlene. Holly, would you respond?
Yeah, the oil industry has said repeatedly that there were, no accidents and no spills as a result of the 2005 hurricanes. But, from someone who lives on the Gulf Coast, we go back and look at the data from the Minerals Management Service, which is the federal agency that regulates offshore drilling. And they report that Hurricanes Katrina and Rita destroyed 113 oil platforms and damaged 457 pipelines. During the whole season of hurricanes in 2005, the Minerals Management Service reported 124 spills that totaled over 700,000 gallons of petroleum from offshore rigs and platforms and pipelines that were caused by the hurricanes. And, one of the other types of accidents that we're concerned about is, happened during Hurricane Rita, which is when a double-hulled tanker barge hit a submerged oil platform that had been toppled by Hurricane Rita. There was a gash in the barge's hull as a result, and that emptied 3 million gallons of fuel oil into the Gulf of Mexico. So these are not insignificant numbers. or insignificant, you know, incidents. And, you know, it's a huge concern for folks whose livelihood depends on these pristine sugar sand white beaches like we have here in Florida.
Mm-hmm. What about Arlene's point, Sarah, and you alluded to this earlier, that we really need to poke around a lot to find out how much oil is there? How much oil is there? How much do we think might be there?
Well, here's what we have understanding of using the 1980 data, not using modern data. I'll speak to what's on federal lands and offshore areas. So 85% of the lower 48 coastlines are completely off limits and under moratoria. 85%. Most people don't realize it's that much. On those in those offshore areas, and those are all well, they would start 3 miles out, but typical development would start more than 25 miles out. So, again, it's nothing you see from a beach. There's 76.5 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. That's more than 3 years of natural gas that we use in this country at a time when we've been increasing our natural gas imports from increasingly to bring in natural gas now from overseas. Overall, natural gas-wise in this country, we have 650.9, we measure natural gas in trillion cubic feet of natural gas. We use per year 20 to 23 trillion cubic feet. So 650 versus what we use per year is 20 to 23. So we have a lot of natural gas that we could be accessing in this country. That's a clean, burning, clean fuel. It helps our energy transition to whatever, you know, whatever future we want. On the oil side, overall, in all these federal lands, both onshore and offshore, and I'm only referring to non-park, non-wilderness federal lands. I'm not referring to any park lands. The federal government, these 1980 estimates are that there's about 116 billion barrels of recoverable oil. So that's, no, it's not going to make us energy independent. In fact, nothing is going to make us energy independent going into the, I mean, in the next 20 years. But that's still enough oil for 65 million cars for 60 years. And it would also heat our American households that are using oil for heat for another 60 years. There's about 3.2 million households who use oil for heat.
Holly.
Sure. We know we keep talking about how if we just opened up these last areas to drilling that, you know, essentially we would, you know, significantly increase our domestic oil supply and that we would, you know, really start to help solve this problem. But between 1999 and 2007, the number of drilling permits that were issued by the federal government for development of public lands increased by more than 360%. And refining capacity has also increased 20% since 1985. And yet, we still see record oil prices and record gas prices. You know, at the same time, the U.S. has actually been exporting more refined petroleum products during the first quarter of this year, 33% more than in the same time last year. So at the same time that we're talking about needing to increase our domestic oil supply, we see that we are exporting more oil now than we did this time a year ago. So just it doesn't ring true that this is the answer. It seems like, you know, opportunistic push by the oil industry and their allies in Congress to open up these last remaining areas that have been put off limits because we're talking about sensitive marine ecosystems and tourism-based economies that are critical to keeping jobs and businesses in those states. You know, and there's no evidence that new drilling is going to do anything to lower gas prices. In fact, Florida agreed to a compromise just 2 years ago where we opened up 8 million acres off the coast of Florida for new oil and gas drilling. And since then, rather than having any impact both in terms of, you know, actual supply that's helped to bring down demand or the psychological impact that the oil industry says that opening these new areas to drilling would have that would help bring down gas prices, we opened 8 million new acres in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, and 2 years later, we have gas prices that are more than doubled, and the price of oil is more than doubled as well.
Let's go to more phone calls. Melanie from Elkhorn is next. Hi, Melanie.
Hi. Thank you for doing the show. It's a very important topic. My perspective is that we need to be more worried about the global warming issues from the oil rather than the economic problem. And I'm hoping that the high gas prices would force Americans to look at smarter and cleaner energy. So I totally agree with Holly here. And I was hoping she could give me some information, maybe a website, a link to help to oppose this. Is there a link to her website? Is there a website or something to oppose the drilling? I don't believe drilling is the answer at all.
I can give you a grassroots. I don't hear Holly answering.
No, I'm happy to. I was making sure she was done. I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing on my end.
Oh, dear.
But,
okay.
You know, sure, if folks are concerned about this and want to get involved, there's a couple things that they can do. You know, clearly calling your member of Congress is, I think, the most important thing that you can do right now, because that's where the decision is going to be made over the next, you know, few months. The ball is really in Congress's court at this point. For more information, you can visit www.saveourenvironment.org, and you can also visit www.shameonbigoil.com.
Thank you.
And if you'd like another point of view, I'm sure you have a website as well. Sarah?
Yeah, I was going to suggest www.drivesmarterchallenge.org. Drive Smarter Challenge is a campaign from the Alliance to Save Energy, and that's, you know, trying to promote energy efficiency. And I think, you know, turning around the consumption of oil will be the biggest way to reduce the use of it in this country and reduce the greenhouse gas emissions that come out of oil. So that's a great website where you can log in the kind of car that you have and actually see on each, you know, a measure that you could take what the impact will be, both on I don't know if it's the gallons you use or the emission, I think it's the gallons of gas that you use, and how much, you know, sort of the relative energy bill. So you can even do it specific to your car, and it sort of steps you through the different things that every individual can take if they're, you know, finding that high oil prices are hard on their family's budget. So that's another site.
Mm-hmm. And how are we doing when it comes to consumption of oil? Are we lessening our consumption of oil significantly, would you say, or not, Sarah? And then Holly.
No, we've had record demand for oil products in the last few years. So our demand grew very strongly in the first part of this decade when we had strong economic growth. With these very high prices, we are seeing a demand impact. We are seeing people react to the prices. So in, say, the last 6 months, maybe, we have seen more of a demand impact where people are responding to higher prices, and it appears they're trying to consume less.
Mm-hmm. We're not driving as many SUVs. A pretty dramatic decrease in that, right, Holly?
It's true. And in fact, I heard on NPR a few weeks ago that GM was closing some plants that make SUVs, which I think is a pretty incredible announcement that, you know, one of the major automakers is making such a significant move away from sport utility vehicles, particularly given how strong the demand has been for these types of vehicles over the years.
Let's go next. Thanks, Melanie, for your call. We go to Gil from Milwaukee next. Hi, Gil.
Hi. Well, congratulations for your program, and I listen to it every morning. It's a great opportunity to educate. It's amazing. I want to share with you. I used to work for Pemex, the national petroleum company in Mexico, for 3 years. And, well, unfortunately, I have to say that drilling is not the answer. It's just amazing how fast they destroy the area.
How was the area destroyed, Gil? What are you talking about?
Well, like 40 years ago, that was my mom's hometown. It was a paradise. There's archaeological ruins. There's it was a paradise.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's a mess. Like if you have seen the typical image in TV of the dirty hometown, the dirty town in Mexico, well, that's what it is now. It's dirty, it's messy, there's no animals. Mm. We used to have a paradise, and now it's just oil and oil and all. And seriously, I really don't want that happen to Alaska or to South Dakota. It's just amazing that they don't see this. It happened to Venezuela. It happened to Mexico. It's amazing.
Thank you, Gail, for your call. Sarah?
Yeah, well, I can't speak to that particular experience, but I do know that the environmental laws and regulations in this country are different than those in Mexico's. In fact, when it comes to, you know, these development processes, for example, they tend to be some of the strictest in the world here in the United States. So when we face a choice between importing oil from other countries and developing some of the oil that we have here, that's also something to consider. We're still consuming it. Our imports are rising. We could create some jobs here, particularly at a time when we're experiencing job loss in this country. This industry right now employs about 1.9 million people directly and another several million indirectly. So there are job opportunities, and you know, I think the environmental regulation is quite different in this country.
Mm-hmm. Do you worry that paradise will be spoiled in the United States if we allow drilling? Holly, do you have any evidence of that?
You know, back in the 1990s when Chevron was proposing to drill in the Gulf of Mexico about 25 miles south of Pensacola, where you know, several publications have named those beaches some of the best beaches in the world, Chevron actually hired an oceanographer to study the spill potential, and that oceanographer found that under worst-case conditions, if there was a spill, it could be brought ashore much faster than any response team could get there to clean it up. We've already had some problems here in Florida with things like red tide, which is where we have algae blooms off the coast, and it's literally emptied the beaches and been devastating for those businesses along the coast down in southwest Florida. So we do, you know, definitely worry about the potential for, you know, a catastrophic spill or even a small spill like the one that washed up on the beach in Tampa Bay in the early 90s. But I think we're also worried about the routine pollution and the routine, you know, small spills and releases from the rigs and you know, platforms and pipelines that are associated with the industry. And then I think, you know, the final thing that we're really concerned about is that the closer drilling gets to Florida's coast, the more likely it is that we're going to see real industrialization of the coastline with, you know, ports and refineries and pipelines, you know, and channels dug, you know, through seagrass beds for these pipelines to bring the product onshore. You know, the closer it gets to Florida's coast, the more likely it is that we're going to have to build all this infrastructure to go with it. And I don't think that's something that most folks want to see happen, you know, off of our beaches.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to an email, this one directed at you, Sarah. Carl from Caledonia, Minnesota. Why would we expect to pay less for oil if it originates in the United States? Our oil companies are just as greedy as anyone else.
Actually, our oil companies in their earnings earn less than the average Standard & Poor's average industrial company. So their earnings tend to be, on average, less than average. They've been slightly above average the last year or two, and I'm talking about maybe earning 8.3 cents on the dollar instead of 7.3 cents on the dollar. There are some industries that are earning maybe 20 and 25 cents on the dollar. So, no, they're not. And earning, you know, the numbers are large because the companies are large. So I know that when earnings are reported, the numbers sound huge to people, and they feel like they're getting, you know, that something unfair is going on. But that's because this is a large industry. These companies are integrated, and they operate all over the world. And, you know, just the oil that's in your gas tank today may very well come from the deep water Gulf of Mexico and, you know, was put in development 10 or 15 years ago. But it takes almost $1 billion to go out into the deep water Gulf of Mexico and years. Holly was sort of talking about, oh, we offered up some lands 2 years ago. Well, it takes about 2 years to do all the geological research to understand where you might want to look for oil. So you don't just offer up land and then, you know, you don't have a little bright red arrow that says drill here and here's the oil. You have to go do the research. So it takes a lot of investment, and that's part of what, you know, taking time in terms of using these lands and continuing to feed oil and gas into the system.
Mm-hmm. Holly, do you think oil companies are greedy?
Well, I think I'd let the numbers speak for themselves. In April, Shell and BP recorded record profits. Shell's profits the first quarter of this year were $9.8 billion, which is up 25%. BP recorded profits that were up 63% to $7.62 billion. You know, you often hear that the oil companies are making less, profit per dollar, but they're actually, when you consider that gas prices are going up, several dollars per gallon, when you look at their actual profits per gallon of gas, they are through the roof.
Do you want to counter that, Sarah?
Yeah, actually, what we haven't talked about this entire show is where I'd like to take this by countering, which is, we were talking about, well, if we produce this oil, what impact is it going to have on our prices? It is very true that we operate with respect to oil in a very globalized market. So oil is bought and sold all over the world. And actually, the oil and gas companies that people hear, these earnings of here, these big five integrated companies, they own only a very small percentage of the world's oil reserves, less than 6%, and they're producing only a very small amount. Each one is about 3%. So the biggest oil producers are these large national oil companies. So you have these companies, these publicly held companies, that are held by shareholders, a lot of retirement funds, investment funds, those kinds of things, and they're competing with national oil companies. But you have lots of oil being produced all over the world, bought and sold, and you really have kind of one global price for oil. So it is correct that if we add production to the system, we can't transform the price of oil overnight. So why should we do this? Well, the reason we should do this is the situation is actually going to get worse, not better, if we don't do anything. There's a lot of strong global demand for oil. China, India, economies that are developing. And so they're putting a lot of upward pressure on the demand for oil. That's not going to go away. So doing nothing is only going to make the situation worse. The United States is never going to be with conventional oil. Of course, with unconventional oil like oil shale, we have Saudi Arabia's reserves. But, we're not going to replace our energy overnight, but each bit of supply is going to help. Saudi Arabia's supply to this country is only about 10% of what we consume in this country. We really produce a lot of our own energy right now, about 45% of our oil and gas. So continuing to produce that in the face of this globalizing economy while we develop, our renewables are growing at much faster than our oil and gas consumption in this country. So the development of renewables, their share of our total energy pie is growing very rapidly. My point is just that this takes time, and so we need everything. We need all sources of energy right now. We can't afford to cut something off. We need the renewables alternatives, but we're also going to need the oil and gas.
But if we do the exploration here, I'm a little confused about this. It then goes on the global market, right? And if it's not a whole lot of oil that we're getting here, how does that significantly lower the price of gas for the global market? Ultimately for us.
I think the question is what's going to happen to the price if there's not production. And I think the impact to our economy is far worse. Our imports are now around 60%, probably a little bit less than that. So that's a lot of dollars and a lot of economic activity that we're importing from overseas instead of producing here at home. So there's a chance to benefit from that here at home and put upward support on the value of our dollar internationally. I think going forward we will continue to be a global market for oil. In terms of what drop of molecule of oil we consume, it is likely to stay here because it would benefit from the largest, most transparent market here in the United States. You wouldn't transport oil overseas. Holly talked about exports before, but they're really kind of product specific and they're minuscule. We're still a net importer. We export things that we don't use. Like if we have a mild winter, we might export some of the heating oil that was not used by the end of the year. And that's typically the case as we go into the warmer months. The heavier products that we didn't use in our heating systems are what get exported from the United States. But we're basically consuming most of what we produce of our own resources.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that, Holly?
I think that, I just look at what the Bush administration's own energy analysts have said, which is that if we opened up these areas off the coast and areas in Alaska that are currently off limits to drilling, that, it's going to be at least 20 years before we'd see significant supply increase. And, in fact, the Energy Information Administration says that if we opened up all those areas in Alaska that are currently off limits, the best case scenario would be a price drop of about 1% per barrel of oil in 2028. And so I think you go back to there's a something that government planners and decision makers like to use a lot, which is a cost benefit analysis, which is basically a kind of wonky way of saying that you weigh the cost against the risk or the benefit. And when you look at it that way, the cost for opening up these last pristine marine ecosystems to drilling that are critical to a number of these states' economies, it's a huge risk, and the benefit is small. It's a long way off, and you also have to look at the cost of this missed opportunity to invest, those resources and direct public policy to investing resources in developing a clean energy economy. And so it just doesn't make sense. It's a bad long-term investment.
We need to pause for a moment and we'll return. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. President Bush yesterday lifted a number of years of executive orders banning drilling for oil and natural gas off the country's coast, and he did this to challenge Congress to step up to the plate and open up more areas for exploration, saying that it would do a great deal to ease the energy crisis and thinking that perhaps this time was ripe for a change because of $4.11 average gas prices all over the country. Democrats, however, said that it was not an effective measure, and so we're talking about that this hour. Our guests are the senior economist at the American Petroleum Institute, Sarah Banaszak, and Holly Binns, who is field director for Environment Florida. Our lines are all filled, but you might be able to get through before the end of the hour. 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. And the email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, the author of Snoop, What Your Stuff Says About You. Do the things on your desk betray the thoughts on your mind? Does your dining room decor carry clues to your character? For the last 10 years, an award-winning psychologist has been studying how we project and protect our inner selves. He has checked out bedrooms and offices, iPods, and looked at personal websites to find out what can be learned about us simply by looking at our stuff. All right, let's go to more phone calls. Habu from Madison is next. Hi, Habu.
Yes, thank you for a very interesting conversation about this very pressing matter. Just two very quick points. One is, and you'll have to excuse me if you've already spoken about this because I joined it 15 minutes later, but nobody really talks when they talk about offshore oil drilling and the price of oil, which is our existential problem today, about the war in Iraq and our threats to Iran and destabilizing that whole region. Nobody mentions that. That is really the cause of the price rise and the speculation. And from some economists, there's a premium of almost $80 to $100, which is really a war premium or a speculation premium. The second point, and I think we as Americans have to be very cognizant of this. Yes, we don't want to spoil our pristine lands, but a lot of this oil comes from other countries, and they have spoiled their lands, like the UWA in Colombia, who threatened mass suicide if there was going to be an oil rig running, or oil lines were going to be going through Colombia, their lands. And the Ogoni people in the Niger Delta, and we saw people like Ken Sarawewa executed. And so this is a whole question of NIMBYism and, preserve our resources while we despoil other parts of the world. We have to ask ourselves, what are we doing to conserve? And we ought to also open up our own lands rather than appear to be so selfish. And thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Habu, for the call. Sarah?
Yeah. Well, I also want to thank Habu. I think he raises good points, and that's what I was trying to say about, you know, we have some of the strictest regulations here in the United States. So, you know, developing our resources, in some ways, they'll be developed under greater scrutiny here than many of the, you know, I'm not an expert on all the details of the regulations in other countries, but I think there's certainly, you know, and there are great programs to use the resources in the Gulf states. They use a lot of the resources to address, conservation of the Gulf areas, which are not just, you know, a result of this oil and gas production. They're much more a result of human activity. Holly had talked about the red tides. I'm curious if there's a science that connects the red tides to the oil and gas exploration industry specifically, because a lot of the impacts that we see, they're not related to the production of the oil and gas in the offshore areas. They're related to the sum total of human activity. So I think Habu raises interesting points.
Here's we have a couple emails. Let me try to condense them because they have the same message, and these go to you, Holly. The message we used to have was conserve in the 80s and early 90s. We forgot that and began to drive these big gas-guzzling machines as if there was enough oil to last forever. Our solution now seems very short-sighted and fosters continued dependence on oil. We need to change our scope and think bigger and collectively. That from Vicky from Milwaukee, and John from Madison is saying what no one is suggesting, including Barack Obama, is that we might want to think about our presence on this planet, how long we think we can last as a species, and an infinite growth model of being. If we really intend to have economic growth forever, then no matter how much oil is found anywhere, it will never be enough. Holly? Hello, Holly, are you there? I don't know what happened to Holly. Holly? Oh, there we go. We got to press that button. Did you hear that, Holly?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and your response to that, it kind of goes to you.
Thanks. Well, I think my response goes to both the folks on email and also our last caller, which is that, you know, the bottom line is that we will never drill our way to energy independence because we simply don't have those resources available, particularly when you match that up against the levels of consumption here in the U.S. And I think, you know, it's been there's a whole set of reasons that, you know, we have gotten to this point today. Clearly, you know, one of those reasons is that the automakers for decades have resisted any effort to require them to make vehicles that go farther on a gallon of gas, or that, you know, are able to run on, you know, fuels other than straight gasoline. You know, we're starting to see, you know, a slow changing of that dynamic now, but it's, you know, in some ways almost, you know, too little too late. The one thing I would say is that, you know, this is the same country that put a man on the moon. My father worked for the space industry for 30 years, and, you know, this is, I think, one of the most technologically advanced economies in the world. And if, you know, a country like Germany can make solar power one of the major resources that's running their energy systems today, you know, then there's no reason that we can't have that same sort of transformative energy policy. But what has been severely lacking is the vision and the political leadership to put those policies into place that are both going to jumpstart the clean energy economy, transform, you know, our energy mix over the short term, the medium term, and the long term, and really take us in a direction where we're not reliant on, you know, foreign dictators that hate us, where we're not, you know, despoiling other places in the world. But I don't think that just because we're despoiling other places in the world, that that's a great excuse to start ruining some of the last pristine areas in this country as well. The solution instead is to really get ourselves off of oil, to do it much more quickly than we're talking about right now, and that's going to take real political leadership.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree, Sarah, that the ultimate solution is to get ourselves off oil?
There's a saying actually put out by a former OPEC oil minister who said, the Stone Age didn't end when we ran out of stones. And I don't think the oil age is going to wait until we run out of oil to end. So I think we will be off oil long before we run out of it. And I think that's the direction we're headed. The timetable is up to all of us altogether.
And when do you think that might be?
I don't know. I do know that the Department of Energy or the Energy Information Administration, even when they look at climate change scenarios where you're imposing dramatic new sets of energy programs in this country, that in the next 20 to 30 years, we still consume a great deal of oil and gas.
Thank you both very much for being with us this hour. It was a good discussion and an important discussion. We'll have more of them. Sorry, we couldn't get to all of your emails. There were tons of them, nor your phone calls, because there were tons of phone calls as well. Offshore drilling, our conversation this hour, prompted by President Bush lifting two decades of executive orders banning drilling for oil and natural gas off a country's shoreline. This, of course, would have to be agreed to by Congress, and there's no thought that that's something that's going to happen anytime soon, really. Our guests, Holly Binns, Field Director for Environment Florida, and Sarah Banaszak, Senior Economist for the American Petroleum Institute. Thanks to Jonathan Anderson and Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour of radio, and thanks to John for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Should have some fun the next hour of our program today, so join us as you look around at all of your stuff. I'm Kathleen Dunn, news ahead, and we'll return with more Tuesday Conversation here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.